We'll reconvene to the open session, and we'll start out with the pledge to the flag. Director Sparks, will you please lead us?
Sure. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We have no need for a roll call since we have the same attendance that we did going into. John, could we please have the report out of closed session, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. President, members of the board, members of the audience. At approximately 6:05, the board did adjourn to closed session. Although there are a number of items that are listed on the closed session agenda, the ones that were actually discussed in closed session was the bankruptcy case, which is agenda item number one, and the Golden State or the groundwater adjudication in the ISJ. In both those instances, they did hear an update from legal counsel, but did not take reportable action. Item number B on the closed session agenda under personnel matters is the general manager's performance evaluation. I wanted to just make it clear that this is pursuant to contract, which calls for an evaluation at this time period. The board did commence the evaluation process and continued this matter to the next agenda.
Item one on the agenda says receive report out of closed session.
Yes.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Go ahead. With regard to the bankruptcy, I understand that there is a mediation to be heard July 19th, I believe. I think the community would like to know what you're offering the creditors. I think before you offer them anything, you should have our buy-in and approval as some sort of offer to those creditors. I'd like to remind you that the water department is some 2,700 of the 4,700 in the prohibition zone.
And point of order, is this, are we in general public comment yet?
So I'll continue. The 2,700 of the 4,700 water customers are 2,700. Prohibition zone is 4,700. The bankruptcy debt and the Tri-W property belong to the prohibition zone. The district needs to clear its offer with the community. We'd like to be informed. And this, perhaps it's a rumor, would be a significant blow to our water bills. But I have a pretty good source. And I think that you've got a fight on your hands if you think you're going to tax the water department for the bankruptcy. So, thank you.
John, before you go, in the letter that the district did send, we did identify the Midtown site as our largest tangible asset. That is a true statement.
And I would agree with that. Number two is, I don't know how to say this politely, but let me just say it legally. We can't tax the water department or any department, the fire department. We can't collect rates from the fire department, the water department, whatever sewer departments. We can't special tax water departments, sewer departments, fire departments without a vote or a protest procedure from its residents. That's number one. Number two is, as to the announced rumor, I just heard the rumor for the first time. Just heard the facts of the rumor for the first time. As far as I know, and I think I would know, I have heard of no such theory being offered as a resolution, period.
Thank you.
With Californians' lives, whether it is for recreation or business. 9 out of 10 Californians will visit California beaches this year. This staggering statistic shows that the importance of keeping and maintaining a coastline free of marine debris, otherwise known as trash, so all Californians can enjoy a clean ocean and beach. Marine debris not only affect the aesthetics of our beaches, but more importantly, they affect the health and diversity of our Central Coast's unique wildlife. Wildlife can mistake plastic and other marine debris for food, which is, more often than not, results in death. Economically, when massive amounts of marine debris are concentrated on our beaches, this can adversely affect tourism on the Central Coast. Our beaches are a major part of the attraction from outside visitors who may not be lucky enough to live in an area with beautiful coastline. In that respect, doing our best to keep marine debris off our beaches and out of our oceans is an economically smart choice. I believe here on the Central Coast, we do have an exceptional love and respect for our coastlines and pride ourselves on the cleanliness and beauty of our beaches. However, we must always keep in mind that we are human and we are the source of most of that trash and marine debris. Your sponsorship supports our hardworking volunteers on Coastal Cleanup Day. So I personally would like to thank you for sponsoring this event last year with EcoSlow and hope you will continue your support this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker.
Don Bearden, Los Osos. I had a little trouble getting the hold of an agenda today. I had to go down to the office to get it because our website is not up yet. I was wondering if, in addition, we're not notified anymore about when the next meeting is coming. I was just wondering, since we still have relations with AGP Video, if a few days before the next meeting, we could post the agenda on Channel 20 and also post when the meeting is going to be, in addition to whenever our website gets up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. I had an interesting mail delivered to me, which has some statistics concerning how much of the federal budget is being spent on the various things the federal government does. And not amazing, at least not to me, was the fact that 59% of the federal budget is spent on war or the consequences of war. Now, this amount that's being spent on the military amounts to $1.98 million a minute, which translates, if you have an hour, we're talking about 118 million. Almost 119 million. If you have 2 hours, you got 237 million. It's almost $238 million. Hey, why don't they give us 2 minutes of their time? It would solve every problem that we have in this community. And I'm sure that you can carry this on and think of other ways of spending money. We have bases in 120 countries. Amazing. In any case, if you want to find out more about what's happening, unfortunately, the Tribune doesn't cover this stuff. Go to www.oneminuteforpeace.org and read more about it. I'm sort of hoping that maybe at a future meeting I'll be back asking the board to take a position, because some communities have already taken positions against this outrageous spending.
Thank you.
It's not helping us. And when one other
we have a problem with the timer, because that's, we're on 4 minutes now, so.
What happened?
We did.
I didn't get a warning. I have one sentence more.
Just go ahead and finish. But
you know, when you consider what's being done to the veterans here in this county, they're no longer being afforded the ability to be taken to Los Angeles when they need treatment. Because the reason is we have too small of a facility here. If you go look at Santa Maria, where they have a bigger facility, there it's okay to take them to L.A.
Thank you. Could we just take a break here until we get our timer fixed?
Regarding the money spent, according to the agreement on page 10, line 8, the non-treasurer party shall be provided full access to all documents associated with the budget. There was to be a budget treasurer, and all invoices for budget expenses shall be submitted to the treasurer every 30 days. To my knowledge, correct me if I am in error, I have not seen any kind of a budget statement from the ISJ to the CSD. We here in the community are being charged not only by the ISJ for the CSD's funding, we are also being charged by the county's funding to the budget of the water, the sewer project. We are also being charged by Golden State Water Company, which got their first adjustment in January, applied to the state. The second one they just did in June, and it is for a 12-month period, which is supposedly to cover the cost for the ISJ. Have we in this community, or has our general manager or our chairman of the CSD ever seen an accounting of what the ISJ is costing this community? Forget about Golden State. Forget about anything else but to this CSD. Can we, will we ever get an accounting? Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker.
My name is Keith Weimer, Los Osos Sustainability Group, and my comments are along the same line. I'm continuing to be concerned about the ISJ. It has basically all the responsibility now. We were able to get some progress through the wastewater project to get some conservation in place, but now the rest of any progress towards conservation is going to be through the ISJ for the most part. In the Coastal Commission staff report, there was indication that the outdoor component of a conservation program is going to be handled by the ISJ. I continue to have trouble with the ISJ being so insulated from public review, and even it seems from the director's direct contact with, you know, and all of this. Well, it's not attorney-client privilege. It should be public information. And one of the big concerns is that when you, you know, when a basin plan is developed and it comes out to be, you know, something that's worked out over a period of time, well, it's going to be pretty much a completed product once it comes out. There won't be a lot of input. There should be more input along the way. And I'm very concerned about the lack of what seems to be genuine interest in a strong conservation program. All the experts we talk to say that in order to stop seawater intrusion in the near future, the most cost-effective, direct, and quickest way is through an aggressive conservation program, and that means 500 acre feet or so in the urban compartment, which means 200 to 250 indoor and 200 to 250 outdoor, And the ISJ and the participants in the ISJ have not shown a strong interest in conservation. One of the points that that Gwen just brought up, back in October, there was a funding that you authorized for a consultant, Bill Mattias, to participate with the ISJ and develop some cost analyses. I'm not sure that that was done. I'd like to know if that was done.
Thank you. Do we have anybody after Frank? Okay. We'll have Alon and then Richard, and then we'll close public comment. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Jeff Edwards. Now that the Coastal Commission has approved the wastewater project, it's time for the purveyors to step up to the plate. It's unfortunate because, as I've suggested in earlier discussions, what needs to be done now should have been included with the project, but it was not. So what I'm here this evening to reiterate is that I have serious reservations about the summertime disposal plan that's associated with the wastewater project, particularly agricultural and urban reuse components. I don't think they're going to work. I don't think the opportunities exist in this situation, and I won't go into the details now. I will suggest that the Los Osos Creek continues to be a location that we can put treated effluent. You have half of the treated effluent basically now, you and Golden State. What are you going to do with it? I think it's a big question. It's also generally accepted that this district's going to end up with a wastewater project when it's built. County's going to hand it over, give you the keys. Well, I think this problem is going to continue. What do you do with all the water? You can't rely on Broaddrison 100%. You can't rely on Broaddrison year-round. So what are you going to do with the water? I would urge this body to get with Golden State through the ISJ. Maybe that's one thing the ISJ could do that would be productive. One possibility for them to do something constructive. Do a joint application for an NPDES permit with the Regional Water Quality Control Board and put the water back in the basin. We can talk about modifying our extraction patterns, pumping from the lower or the upper, doing this, blending that, but until you return the water to the basin, you're not going to stop seawater intrusion. I'll tie this into the discussion later after the presentation by Rob Miller and friends. Thank you.
Frank Cilio, Los Osos. I want to reiterate some of the questions I asked Supervisor Gibson last time at LOCAC. One of the questions was, does an LCP, a local coastal plan, an HCP, a habitat conservation plan, need to be in place before a 218 for undeveloped properties is put forward? He stated that, no, they can go forward without the LCP and HCP with a 218. The other question was, what happens if a 218 does not pass by the undeveloped properties? What would be the additional cost that those of us in a prohibition zone would pick up? And he stated somewhere between $15 and $35 more per month on service charge. I have an email, and I didn't bring it now, but I will drop it by the office to give it to Mr. Gilmore for to give to each of you from the county that didn't give the exact figures that Supervisor Gibson gave. They put in a lot of what-ifs. There's a lot of variables there, so they don't know, which is unfortunate that the county's not capable, or doesn't want to do it, to work out the scenarios, because there's so many scenarios. You know, if we get the SRF loan, or if we get the grants, or if we get, you know, they know the USDA, so they know what areas that are possible, and they can run the scenarios on not the wells and the lack of count in those wells then. Thank you.
Okay, Alon, and then Richard, and then we'll close public comment.
Hello, Alon Perlman, Los Osos. Well, it's July, and we're about as far away from the rainy season as we can be. The Frugro Group has done a sales survey previously, well, it was the right time to do so. Right now, the fence has collapsed further. So this fence that you own, you now own, is starting to fall. Gravity does that to fence. It sucks them down to the earth. And the fence is continuing to fall into the chasm that was created and was enhanced when the county put in the Palisades project. So I hope that you can work just to stabilize that fence on this side, because that's not the side where the snails are. About 3 years ago, well before the Palisade project was put down, just knowing that the terminus for that project would be on the Tri-W property, Midtown property, I asked the county to be sure that on the right-of-way side, which is what the county owns, that they would put a large amount of riprap, because the waters would end up coming out of there in great force and in a larger amount than had been historically been there. And it turns out I was right, and it happened that the Palisade drainage project was actually completed, or not entirely completed, but was intact at the point that we had what I believe is 4 25-year rain events, which did a lot of washing away of the property further down. So between now and the rainy season, I would suggest that you protect your property, the people's property, by contacting the county, who may or may not act sooner or later, and have them add additional riprap, because there is a jurisdictional uncertainty on the property itself. But the county does own that right-of-way element where that pipe lets out, and there's nothing wrong with asking them to lay down a large amount of riprap in a fan pattern so that it would spread out whatever waters are to come there in the next rainy season. And yes, Los Osos Creek is a good place to recharge the aquifer, and no,
it's the corner of Bayview Heights and Ocean View Drive. That Saturday from 8 to 3 is the rummage sale for the Maxine Lewis Memorial Shelter. All of the proceeds from this rummage sale, this is our second year we've done this, go towards the matching funds at the December 11th Needs and Wishes fundraiser here at the Community Center. If anybody has anything to donate, and we're talking quality items, we don't want small household appliances that don't have the cord, you know, broken dishes, you know, those type of things. But anything of quality that you'd like to donate, you can call either P.D. Johnson, whose house the rummage sale is being held at 528-7638, 528-7638, or Carla Poole at 534-9182, or any of you that know me, you can just contact me and we can figure it out. If you don't want to call anybody and you would just like to drop off items, you can drop them off the Friday before on the 16th in the afternoon. Anytime after 12 o'clock, people will be there setting up for the next day. And I just have to mention quickly, the growth of the Needs and Wishes fundraiser, we've always portrayed it as a countywide event. And I understand, I heard from somebody today that when the flyer went out on the email list, I guess Dana Lilly from the county staff actually was talking about this rummage sale at the Planning Commission meeting this morning. So, you know, the people that are it's going out to are also helping spread the word throughout the county. Again, July 17th, all of the proceeds go towards the matching funds for the Christmas event, and hope to see you there and hope you have something to donate. Anybody has any questions, let me know.
Thank you. With that, we'll close general public comment. The next item on the agenda is the presentation. For those of you who remember, two meetings ago, we had an initial presentation by Spencer regarding the seawater intrusion study that was released 2 days prior to that. We had a number of questions raised about that presentation.
All right. Good evening, President Ohilski, members of the board, members of the public. As everyone knows by now, the seawater intrusion update and peer review were recently completed as part of the ongoing basin adjudication referred to as the ISJ. A presentation of these studies was given to the board at the public meeting held on May 6th. This item has been scheduled to give the board and the public the opportunity to ask questions about those studies. I won't go into a lot of detail, but I thought I'd give a brief summary of the results. The primary goal of the project is to determine the safe yield of the groundwater basin, to establish maximum entitlements of the basin users to that yield, and to develop a groundwater management plan. The groundwater management plan is intended to document the basin yield and each purveyor's share of the resource while addressing seawater intrusion, stabilization, and sustainability of the basin. The recent studies have brought a greater understanding of the local groundwater basin than ever before. The studies have resulted in a model that predicts with relative certainty how the basin responds to rainfall, creek flow, percolation, and extractions from the various aquifers. According to the studies, the safe yield of the upper aquifer, Zone C, for a balanced basin under current conditions is 1,700 acre-feet per year. That assumes that existing nitrate contamination is either removed or adequately treated. The safe yield of the lower aquifer, Zones D and E, is estimated to be 1,500 acre-feet per year. The distribution of upper aquifer versus lower aquifer yield varies across the basin, with most of the lower aquifer yield in the east side and Los Osos Creek Valley. After subtracting water production allocated to agricultural irrigation, private domestic use, and golf course irrigation, the safe yield distribution for water purveyors is 1,460 acre-feet per year from Zone C and approximately 640 acre-feet per year from Zones D and E. The study used the model to develop a list of recommendations for inclusion in the ISJ's groundwater management plan for balancing the basin and addressing seawater intrusion. Those recommendations are, number one, to relocation of wells and ag exchange. Two is aggressive water conservation. The third one is nitrate removal from water extracted from Zone C. The fourth one is the use of shallow wells. There may be opportunities to reduce pumping from Zones C, D, and E by using shallow wells from Zones A and B for irrigation. Number five is brackish water desalinization. Number six is rainwater harvesting. And number seven is the installation of graywater systems. The studies predict that with successful implementation, a group is also here to help answer questions.
Mr. President, if I might, we understand that there has been a number of questions that have been recorded, and we're prepared to respond to those tonight. I had a few brief prepared comments that perhaps I could present at this time. I won't walk everybody through the same slides, but if they do come up in the question and answer period, the extent of seawater intrusion and so forth, we do have those available on the PowerPoint here if we can get it to respond with a mouse click. Moving at breakneck speed. While that's thinking, I would like to thank the board for scheduling a follow-up presentation. Didn't get to attend last time because of a scheduled vacation. I can tell you that'll work. So we do have the slides that set forth the latest test results that show that the extent of seawater intrusion has marched forward over the last number of years since we last performed testing. And then a few thoughts here. There we go. Just a few introductory comments, and I think Dan did a very good job sort of framing the whole issue. As a person who does participate in the ISJ process, I could tell you there is some tension here this evening, and that tension would be the desire to share as much information as possible. Those of us who have been through the Los Osos public process many times know that there are lots of folks here that study these issues in great detail, provide a level of comment that is beyond general thoughts and as technical merit. And so we'll try to be as inclusive as we can as we answer questions here tonight, but do understand we have other partners there that we have to respect as we provide information. Also, we know that future elements of these projects and these strategies are going to be subject to coastal review, and they're going to be through an extensive public process, another reason to try to get as much information out to the public as possible, as soon as possible. So I echo some of those previous sentiments. A few, I think, key items to focus on to perhaps augment nitrate concentrations vary throughout the upper zone. They can be difficult to predict. And so when we do drill upper zone wells, though we believe we have a good strategy there, we know that we'll need flexibility of funding, flexibility of strategy. We also know that a number of community members have expressed concern over constituents in the water that are of such trace amounts that we don't normally test for them in our current Department of Public Health requirements, but they are of concern because they're known to be in the water. We want to be very transparent about that. I know that throughout the county, those constituents are also present, but we have some good information here in Los Osos. We want to mention that. That's a couple years old now. As far as conservation goes, I know that there's been significant strides that have been made under the wastewater project as far as indoor use goes. And in answer to one public comment, I think it was Keith, there is a consultant that is advising the ISJ. It's Bill Madouse with Madouse Water Management, an expert in water conservation, and he is looking at both our indoor and outdoor programs. And I heard some numbers here tonight that resonate with some of the thoughts that I've had as far as the quantities that we're looking for conservation. Nitrate removal, we have done, again, without getting into excessive detail, a significant amount of work on the economics of nitrate removal. Perhaps you've heard folks express concern that, can you really do that? It generates a brine product. Is this really going to work? I can tell you that we've looked at the brine disposal issue. We've looked at the cost per acre foot, the viability of this, the capital cost. We have an increasing level of comfort that nitrate removal is a viable technology. It's done locally. Grover Beach has a significant unit, and we can share some of those costs here tonight if you're interested. And then, of course, under the new Coastal Commission approval, we do have a lot of recycled water planning to do, and the ISJ group is undertaken that to both reduce outdoor use and to look at ag exchange, as Dan has said. And then I thought it would be an interesting exercise to look at probably the two most important elements that are facing us to balance the space. And one is funding. And obviously, given the constraints of Proposition 218 and the need to secure funding, that will be a critical item. We're quickly aware that every day that goes by is another day where salt is intruding on the basin. So just some initial thoughts. Again, Spencer and I are available to respond to detailed questions, and we know you have a list here tonight for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Does any of the board members have specific questions at this point? No? Okay. With that, I will open it to the public. You'll have 3 minutes to ask questions or make comments, so use your time wisely. Thank you.
Keith Weimer, Los Osos Sustainability Group. Thank you, Rob. Shift to the upper aquifer. You didn't mention a concern about seawater intrusion. Gus Yates pointed out that too much shifting of pumping can cause that, so I'd like to know what you think the safe yield of the upper aquifer is, how much you can shift to that. Nitrate removal. I know there was a feasibility study done last June. We did get that bit of information with our request. Why is it taking so long to get that going? I mean, obviously, that's been something that's been a priority for a long time, so I'm wondering about timing on that. We are concerned about the seawater intrusion. Obviously, that's going to be something that's used, so why is it taking so long? Opportunities for recycled water. Let's see. I'd like to know what the cost analysis entails for conservation. I want to make sure that it's evaluated against the cost of desal. Let's see, how long will it take to bring water levels up? The only way to stop seawater intrusion is to bring the water levels up in that low, depression, pumping depression. So I want to know what the target is and how long it will you expect it to take to bring that up to sea level. That's the only thing that will stop seawater intrusion. The 2009 ISJ TMs indicated that you would still allow 250 milligrams of chlorides to impact some of the wells. I'd like to know that that's not going to be happening because that's not controlling seawater intrusion. That's inviting seawater intrusion. Let's see. And one of the things they continue to recommend was that Spencer develop an uncertainty level. So I'm wondering if the uncertainty margins have been determined and what those are. Let's see. I want to know exactly what the target is for the lower aquifer, how much reduced pumping there will be, what the safe yield. Are we shooting for 600 acre feet? And if we are, how long is it supposed to take to get there? Is the South Bay well impacted by seawater intrusion?
Thank you. What I'd like to do is, I think if we can answer the questions after each speaker rather than carrying them to the end, that may be the most productive way to go, if that's okay with you guys.
Great. That was quite a list of questions that came out. I thought Spencer and I can tag team a bit here. As far as the shift to the upper zone, perhaps I'll let Spencer speak to his estimate of the yield.
Thank you. Good evening. Spencer Harris, Cleith Harris Geologist.
Just a minute, Mr. President. As before you answer your questions, can we get the presentation back up? Because I think we may want to show for the context some of the, there's a couple wells mentioned and the graphs. I think it'll help as you're going through those to have that.
Thank you. You can go ahead, Spencer. We'll get up as soon as we can.
So the first question I'd like to address is the upper aquifer. And historically, the only seawater intrusion that has been documented has been out on Cuesta by the Sea on that little promontory. There's a shallow well out there that where seawater intrusion was noted. Of course, that's surrounded by the bay, and so that was a shallow influence from the bay. And the other location was the Lower Creek Valley, very close to Turi Creek, which is also an intrusion from the bay. So historically and today, we do not have any seawater intrusion in the upper aquifer. And of course, if you pump too much, it's going to come in to the upper. So the balance that we have between upper and lower takes that into account. The yield numbers for the upper and the lower are, they're sort of a structure in place. Ultimately, the upper aquifer, the yield projections, certainly the model takes into account potential for seawater intrusion.
I'd like to address the timing of nitrate removal. Like, of course, in a multi-party consensus process, things do take quite a long time, particularly when you're expecting imminent information. I could tell you a lot of the consultant work and the technical work gets done rapidly, but the policy levels that surround that take more time to work through in the ISJ group. I could tell you the issue of brine is a significant one for nitrate removal and one that's been well tackled, but a lot of the consultant work was done rapidly. I can also tell you that we did retain an outside expert that's done dozens and dozens of nitrate removal systems. We reached out to find what we thought was one of the top engineers in the state on that technology. We didn't just do our own research. As far as the cost analysis, when it comes to conservation, It is basically a cost-benefit ratio analysis. If you look at the 2000 Urban Water Management Plan that the district did, very similar in character, looking at the cost-benefit. The request was to compare that to desal water, though the cost of imported water is similar. So you're going to see similar economic drivers on cost-benefit when it comes to conservation. How long will it take to bring the water levels up once you begin backing off pumping? Spencer, maybe I'll let you.
I don't have a firm number on how long it would take to do that. The model is run to a steady state condition, so it's a long-term equilibrium, and I just can't put a number on that. I think once we do make some shifts and monitor and track the changes in pressure and how quickly that's taking place, then we can start to project that sort of timeline. But again, the model is more of a steady state equilibrium that we're after. So,
Water quality levels that are unacceptable from a drinking water quality standpoint. That's the edge. The question from a policy standpoint is, do you put your toe on the edge or do you back away from it with a contingency that would allow you to have maybe a little bit of room for uncertainty? Is that a few acre feet or hundreds of acre feet? I could tell you that's something the ISJ is dealing with. And the contingencies that are being considered are more substantial than just a few acre feet. I think folks are realizing that these models are representations of the real world, but there's nothing like monitoring year to year, and to assume that we're going to go all the way to the edge of that safe yield, I think is probably maybe not the best policy decision. So I can tell you that contingencies are being built in. And then that also speaks to the uncertainty level. Of course, a consultant that's doing a peer review wants to have that peer review be of value and look at concrete recommendations that can be made other than just saying, yeah, it looks good to us. So as Stetson looked at this, they came up with a set of recommendations, and in discussing those, there's always improvements that can be made in these models. And I would say that the next iteration of the model, when that occurs, should have those uncertainty bounds in each and every parameter. To do those today would take months more of time and dollars to do that, and it would be extremely unlikely to change any of our course. It would just highlight the fact that there is uncertainty, and so I think it's important to move forward with remediating this problem, but as funding comes in for further iterations of the model, to begin adding that uncertainty functionality. So I know folks might disagree with that, but there's a thought that there's got to be forward motion now as opposed to waiting for and more funding to look at the model again. Then the South Bay well, is that being impacted by seawater intrusion? I'm assuming that was referring to the district South Bay well, because there's several South Bay wells in the community, and I'll let Spencer speak to that.
Thanks, Rob. I don't believe that the South Bay well is being impacted by seawater intrusion. We do see some things going on with the water quality. If you want to scroll, would be 17E7. And in that location, in that well, we had a detection of 110 chloride. So, and 17E8, which is a deeper piezometer, we had 42 chloride. And just a quick, review of 17E7 water quality indicates that there's something very localized going on. You don't have bicarbonate; it's all carbonate alkalinity and hydroxide, which is not typical for groundwater at all. You have virtually no magnesium. There was a precipitate in the water. So There's something happening at the well that's I'm sure just a local phenomenon. I haven't tried to determine exactly what's going on, but I do not believe it's seawater intrusion.
Mr. President, I think that takes us through the list of questions. If I missed some, I apologize.
Okay, with that, we'll have the next speaker.
Good evening. My name is Jeff Edwards. While I'm beginning, perhaps Spencer or Rob could put up the, if you have the boundary of the model, is it coterminous with the basin itself? So anyways, I have numerous concerns about the model. First of all, we all know that the wastewater project's been a primary tool in balancing our basin. Well, if you look at task one, the model was run using a couple wastewater parameters. One was 100% spray fields. 100% spray fields. How that helps us in managing the basin, I'm uncertain. The other one was using Broaderson at 440 acre feet per year and then spray fields. So what scenarios, certainly the current wastewater project hasn't been run as part of this model, and do we have to wait for more money to do that? I don't believe the creek and the what I alluded to earlier about the lower basin surfacing at the creek bottom south of Los Osos Valley Road, I don't think that's been considered in the model at all. And there are many others, but I'll just close on the whole notion of this model with the comment that the peer reviewers weren't really crazy about the model, and they suggested that another type of model be used. So clearly we're going to rely on our upper basin, which is basically the septic returns for the last couple decades. I don't want to drink that water. I'm not sure if you do either. It just doesn't make sense to shift, use that as the sole and main reason that we're going to be able to balance our basin. Jumping into some of the recommendations in the basin management plan actions. Brackish water desal, how did that even get on this list? Is that viable under any scenario in the world? It might be a little cheaper than importing water. That's the only thing I can think of. So, you know, did the consultants, the peer reviewers, or anybody else, have they taken the 10% minimum dedications into account for environmental and for ag that are part of the current wastewater project? Has anybody factored that into a model or any other analysis? Task two. Well, task two is all about extracting 250 acre feet per year from the creek compartment. Well, that'd be great to do that, but what are we adding to the creek compartment? And is that a necessity? Lastly, I'll conclude by saying, you know, we talk about nitrogen removal. We've been talking about nitrogen removal for upper basin water for a long time. Golden State's been talking about it forever. They haven't done it. They have not brought in their ion exchange unit to do the work. And I'll say finally that on your consent agenda item tonight, number 5A or 5I, is all about the South Bay well. What happened to blending? I don't see blending as any scenario under the future.
Thank you. There was just a couple of questions there.
I think there was, and he actually hit on one that I'd forgotten to address in the last presentation. I think with respect to task one, I've heard from a number of folks now that, you know, why was this 100% spray fields even run as an option? Obviously, it's not an option anymore. I think in looking at the bookends, the bounds of what would happen if we exported all of our effluent away from this basin, what would it look like? I think that's an important number. It's an easy scenario to run, was not very expensive, and it's an important number to have so that everyone understands how critical it is that we bring this water back to the basin. And that was, I think, some important input that the purveyors had into the wastewater project. Has the model been run under the newer wastewater condition? Well, that's what we're looking at. That's what we're looking at now. How can we maximize the benefit? There were no substantive issues that they could identify, and they went through each of the different assumptions in the model. And I think that's important, although, again, it is just a model, and I don't want to oversell it. Let's see. Oh, as to the... the upper zone water, the septic return flows for the last 30 years. I mean, some of that you actually are already drinking. It's a blend right now with Zone C. It is completely potable. All the communities, coastal communities, inland communities in this county have similar conditions. They have their wastewater disposal, all of Napomo, Santa Maria, Paso Robles Basin. Throughout this county, groundwater does receive return flows from septic systems and becomes our production water. Maybe that helps or maybe it doesn't. How did DSAL make the list? I think they wanted to be exhaustive on the list. I think you can look at the consultant contracts that get approved by this board and see if you see a contract that says we're going to spend $10,000 looking at DSAL, then I think you can be more concerned that that's going to be a large expenditure. But let's just say it's on the list. But as far as significant technical effort towards it, I think you can look at the scopes that have been approved by this board to see where the technical muscle's being expended. And then have the 10% dedications been taken into account? Yes, that is being factored in to the basin management plan. And then as far as what are we adding back to the creek compartment as we take that water away, certainly the study showed that a significant amount of water continues to flow out to the bay. There are some environmental demands and uses of that water. I think one thing that the folks are certainly talking about and looking at is the use of tertiary water for agriculture. That has challenges. There may have to be incentives to make that happen. But I think in terms of keeping water in that creek compartment, that's one major strategy that is workable, perhaps with incentives, though there has been some interest. And then nitrate removal, why has it taken so long? One reason on the Golden State side is, of course, they've been using their nitrate unit at their other installation. They haven't been able to part with it because of nitrate issues in another water system. We're not waiting around for Golden State. It's going to take time to see those go down before you can implement blending. I think I got through most of those questions. Did you want to add anything?
Well, I'll just add the comment on the model in the creek. The package that's used now in the CWAP model is the river package, and that's how we introduce recharge from the creek into the model. And that keeps a certain amount of water in the creek at all times. So we have to be careful that we don't allow that to let too much water in that doesn't exist because the creek doesn't run year-round. And part of the work that we did was to monitor the flows in the creek and to make sure that the amount of water that was allowing to go into the creek, into the model from the creek, was an appropriate amount that can be supported by real data. Now, the peer review recommendation was to use a stream package for modeling the creek rather than the river package. That was the different approach. And I had to tell Stetson that the CWAT didn't support the stream package at the time. And apparently when this peer review came out, they had called the model developer, and that is now becoming available for the stream package. So that's just a plug-in and use that one instead. But the amount of water that we're allowing, what the stream package would do, it would pulse the water seasonally into the creek. And that, in order to have that be effective, you'd have to convert the model to a full transient model where you'd have either seasons or months where that pulsing would make sense. And that, we don't have that now.
Okay, thank you. Next speaker.
Frank Cilio, Los Osos. My first question is, and I've already asked it, so Spencer, but I didn't get a response, is that a full response. when you have a basin that has a lesser capacity for storage, doesn't the yield change over time? Also, when I reviewed your report back in July 29th, your technical memorandum, I don't know, on your map here, does that basin go all the way past Clark Valley Road? Because it looks like it does from everything I've seen. It goes probably by Paradise Lane. And so I see all that area was left out in your calculations of water being pumped. And if you look at Clark Valley Road, between Clark Valley and Paradise Road, there's a lot of homes. There's homes out there. There's agriculture, organic farm out there. So I think you missed a big chunk. Also, I read the email you sent to Rob, which Mr. Cooney and I worked on, and it stated the some of the wells that I mentioned other places were not really significant because it was a plus or minus 50 acre feet a year. But I think that's important to identify every well, whether it's inactive, because if it's inactive, it can be turned on and it can be used. And that's another draw on the basin, because we need to know how much can be drawn at any time from this basin, because there's controls that the county does have for moratoriums or the Coastal Commission in certain areas for building. But there's certain things that we don't have control on. If there's an inactive well that's legally there but it's not active, that well could be started being pumped. So I'd like to know about that too. Let's see, there's a ton of questions. Oh, in your model, did you, that takes into account, I presume, but you can answer that, about drought years too, when we have a drought, because I know that there was a seawater intrusion in the 60s in the upper aquifer when it was about 30% of the population that there is now. They talked about that. Also, when the study shows that we have seawater intrusion currently moving 700 feet in the last 5 years, compared to the last 20 years from 85 to 95, did you ever map it out, the progression? Was there, you know, like all of a sudden we're going 60, 60 or 45, whatever, 45, 60, and all of a sudden now we're up? I wonder if it was lower 20 years ago, and as it progressed, there's a progression, and so we can see the progression with the amount being drawn out of the basin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Storage capacity. You know, storage capacity by itself doesn't determine the yield of a basin unless it... And so as that seawater moves in, if you're unable to capture leakage now because you can't put a well in that location, then you've lost some of that yield. So it's not the decrease in storage capacity per se. The basin has a tremendous amount of storage capacity, but it's the location where you're removing your ability to capture leakage from the upper aquifer, that's really the bottom line on where you're losing your yield, because the creek valley water you can pretty much capture from the east. For you know the vacant lots, the individual wells, I think you mentioned that twice. That certainly would be a consideration for a build-out figure. What the study that I did on the private well production was for the existing wells. And so if there are wells out there that are either on or that could be put on vacant land or are not used because maybe they're inside of the purveyor's, you know, service district, to what extent those would be used would be added on to a build-out demand. Now, you also mentioned the wells out past Clark Valley, and I do remember that email. There was a discussion there, and the basin does extend out there, but it's thinning, and the productive wells that are out there are not in the basin per se. They're They're either in the metavolcanics or if pretty much in the metavolcanics are where they are. If you go past it and you go down again into Los Osos Valley proper, then there's alluvial water. But I did take a look at it. I remember that, and I don't recall that there was that the wells that I were familiar with, that they were not actually basin, drawing from the basin, because at that point it was very shallow. Again, the basin has a significant amount of storage, so when you do have a drought, you continue to pump from that, and then when the rains come, then they fully recharge, they replenish, not only to provide for your yield for that year, but then there's extra water that then replenishes the storage that you've withdrawn as the drought buffer. And then finally, I think the acceleration question, which is a good question, and I did mention it in the presentation, but I don't have a detail of how that breakdown would have occurred. I mean, yes, earlier on in the late 70s, and when things were just developing, the intrusion was probably very slow, and then it picked up the pace, and it probably did it's probably accelerated sometime during the 90s drought and then slowed down, and now it accelerated again in our recent drought. But overall, it has been accelerating as it's been moving into this trough, this pressure trough, which is in the downtown area, which Palisades is a prominent location in that. So I don't, it didn't go from 60 feet per year to 700 feet per year from one year to the next, but it was transitional.
Thank you.
That's it. Okay, next piece speaker.
Good evening, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. When did you get the model? I remember it was 2004 or something that you got the equipment to 2002? Because I just feel that the it's pretty obvious that it was speeding up, and I think that that's, I feel like it's pretty negligent to not have brought that forward early on during the early sewer talks, because I think, now we're faced with fighting the 2 milligrams of nitrates versus losing our entire basin to saltwater intrusion. And so the focus of the sewer project should have been reevaluated. It's been 20, doing partial sewering, some kind of a solution, and using the money to fix the saltwater intrusion rather than to blow it away on a sewer that's not going to work. Anyway, I guess that's more of a comment. I just believe that you it was very exciting to have the modeling equipment, and I think it's kind of too bad it didn't get used to send up a red flag right away to say, wait a minute, we got a serious problem here. Salinas basically had the feds come in and save their water basin because it was so screwed up. All the private wells gave up ownership of their wells. The district that took over the saltwater reformatting took over. I wonder, too, up in Cambria, when they talked about desal, I think desal has got to be one of the most expensive ways to fix anything. But in Cambria, they talked about doing LID, stormwater collection, as another way to get water back into the groundwater. I don't see that discussed or listed anywhere, and it's far less expensive. There were experts that have done projects in LA and other areas with drought, and building basins and underground storage is another way to increase the water supply. And also, when is the ISJ going to meet with the private wells? We've got all these other water purveyors that are not part of this. I don't understand the secretive ISJ meetings should be including everybody in our basin, if that's what you're trying to do, is look at basin management. So I don't know if maybe Mr. Seitz could explain why they weren't included. I also wonder, is there any discussion about what responsibility the county has in allowing the saltwater intrusion to have been ignored for so long?
Thank you. I think we have questions for Spencer, Rob, and John on this.
Yeah, we can tag team here. I think it's important for folks to understand that the difference between the computerized basin water model that we had, that we have, that was developed in a year or two's time from 2002. We got some grant funds, about $250,000. Had we not received those grant funds, we would definitely not be where we are today. And then that report was published, and the purveyors just continued their normal sampling, their drinking water sampling that they do routinely. And it was only recently, back in 2009, some four years after the last report, that we said we need to go back and resample all of those monitoring wells and look at the physical parameters again. So it was trying to be vigilant to say, this is what the model predicted. We've had some drought. Let's go check it again. So the model doesn't allow us to test in real time what's happening in the ground. We have to physically go out and grab those samples. It's very costly to do that. But we did it in 2009 to provide a check. So just wanted to make sure that difference was understood. And then I do know that in 2006 or 7, we did pursue more grant funding for a partial solution, withdrawing upper aquifer water. We're not successful in getting that listed. And then I'll let Spencer address.
Yeah. On the model and acceleration, the equivalent freshwater head model, which was the model that was developed to quantify seawater intrusion for the 2005 report, that model operates on pressure, strictly on pressure, and it tells us how much seawater is moving through across the coast into the basin. Once it's in the basin, there's no way to track where it goes. That's why in 2009, when the ISJ wanted to run scenarios, the model was converted to a CWANT model, which includes solute transport. So now, you know, not only do we quantify the seawater as it comes in, but then we can see how it flows in the basin. So that was relatively recent. And in the 2005 study, we saw that the precursors, you know, were accelerated. And the movement that was reported was, of course, historical over the 20 years. And since that time, we have D and E. And so even with CWAT, the movement is on a, you know, it's the movement over the whole aquifer, not in the individual pathways. But that's why this model is run to a steady state. It's run until there's no more change in the pressures, because that's more, it's not as important for the ultimate yield, how fast or how slow it moves, but ultimately where the balance is, where the pressures are, and where the distribution of the chloride is when you've achieved your yield. And so there was, the model could not have thrown up a flag saying, you know, 5 years from now, this is what's going to happen. It didn't have the capability of that.
With regard to LID concepts and stormwater collection, I do think those have merit. I think you'll see more discussion of that, particularly when it comes to decommissioning septic systems, but also as we go to rehabilitate streets and other things. I know the county has a few demo projects now in the county that are LID projects, good examples of enhancing percolation, not just trying to get water to run off. And I do know that we pump an awful lot of water to the bay still on our stormwater pump station, so I think you will see those on the list and brought up. And then I think there was a question for John on why not include all the private pumpers. I think that's an important question.
The principal reason that you don't include, or that the ISJ group has, I would say, has been reluctant to include all of the pumpers within the groundwater basin, is based primarily on legal principles and groundwater rights. I think I've talked to the community before about groundwater rights, but principally there are two. There are what's called overlying rights, and then which have prescriptive rights as to the water, and then there are folks like us that have that don't have that status to the groundwater as a purveyor. So when you look at California law, and I'm not trying to justify California law, I'm just trying to reclass of entitlements to water, which would make resolutions much, much more difficult. Also, in trying to balance the relationship between the farmers and the purveyors, we have to actually try to take a look at what their actual pumping is and what could we hope to achieve by bringing the farmers in vis-a-vis what, how much water in the groundwater basin do they use? Is it increasing or decreasing? I can let Spencer address that issue, but I think it's 500 acre feet.
What they're using, 800?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, between 500 and 800 acre feet per year. I also want to point out one other issue besides just the water rights issue is that if the water returned to the groundwater basin as conditioned in the coastal development permit is successful, there will be ag participation to some extent in the groundwater basin, because ag exchange is a principal, one of the methodologies of using the treated effluent. So the theory is if they're using treated effluent, they're not pumping from the groundwater basin, especially the east compartment, that east compartment will then become more, we become, have a greater value for pumping for potable water use for the purveyors. Now, I'll let Rob and Spence contradict that, but that's my understanding from a legal perspective, interpreting engineering and geology. So.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Julie
Tacker. Since we have a hydrogeologist in the room, there's an item on tonight's agenda that poses a question for me. Are we acting like purveyors, or are we acting like basin managers? And that question is repairs to the Palisades Well. Palisades Well appears to be drawing that finger in. And is it wise to fix it and continue to use it? That's a question for you, gentlemen. We've seen kind of this list of recommendations before, this list of six now, for these recommendations relative to the health of the basin, because if it all adds up to be the same amount as importation, then let's cut to the chase and do what we got to do, because we're just losing the basin and just throwing money at it. So that question has to be analyzed and resolved. A question I have for the board is, do you all have the 2006 Upper Aquifer Characterization Study? I know you boys were on the board at the time. The rest of you, have you seen it? I'd like you to reread it. I'd like it posted on your website. And then I'd like to invite the community to read it. Because what's in that upper aquifer, as described by Dr. Vargo, who we sent all the samples to, he says that it's difficult for him to make an assessment regarding the overall water quality and the safety based on the testing data that we have. In my opinion, what has been found so far is not alarming, but at the same time clearly indicates that some contamination of the water has occurred. Additional testing for other potential chemical contaminants should be considered. He says that evidence of wastewater influence on the upper aquifer is not restricted to the salt loading, and it's indicated based on detections of NDMA, maybe you guys can define that for the public, and two PPCPs in multiple wells. The water's not good. If I knew more, I'd probably be more frightened. Because when I see things like dry cleaning fluid, solvents from gas stations, that's not something I want to see my community drink, and it's not something I want to see nursing mothers drink and pass through to their babies. And it becomes an ethical question if this is really the right way to manage the basin by moving our pumping and our distributing of water to the upper aquifer.
Thank you. Before you guys answer, we're running almost onto an hour with this discussion. How many more people do we have? So you have three more? Okay.
Again, why is this taking so long? I can tell you the consultant work is not holding anything up. It's all done in a shorter time frame, again, to build consensus and to address the policy issues. That takes more time than just the technical work, including the cost estimates. And then as far as the upper aquifer characterization study, that was 2006. I can't believe it's been 4 years already. I think that may be on the district's website. If not, it's an excellent study. It's well worth a read and well worth posting because we're going to be talking about it. I can say that, again, virtually every community here locally that uses groundwater is faced with many of the same challenges at trace levels. Does that help everybody? No, it probably is only a little bit of comfort to some. But I know that the state and the federal government, of course, they list those contaminants that they think are worth regulating. They make you test for them on a three-year cycle and treat for them if you don't meet the requirements. And those are changing all the time. And so that's a challenge as a purveyor. How far do you go into these trace elements that are of concern to your constituents? Do you treat for everything, or do you meet the state standards? And so that's an important policy question that an engineer can identify what's there, but to answer that policy question is more difficult. I'll be happy to let Spencer talk about NDMA.
Well, first, let me just say that Dr. Vargo, those comments included recommendations that he had for testing, additional testing, and in fact, that testing was done. The testing that we did for Task 3 was comprehensive and included the items that Dr. Vargo was mentioning. So he didn't have all the data. I mean, it took quite some time for all the results to come in, and his comments were received before, you know, we didn't have the full report for him to look at. But NDMA, as I believe it's a byproduct of chlorination. Carbamazepine was another, and I don't know if I need to go into too much detail here. I you know, I'm sure everyone's going to read it, so.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Well, I was going to probably save these comments for the end, but one of the comments keeps coming up, and that is this brackish water and this desalinization. And I just want to repeat what Rob said at the very beginning. That's on the list. Is it a focus? No. The one thing that is a focus of that is the cost, not the technology to produce it. And the reason why, from my perspective, and everybody could have a different one, is when you take a look at the cost of denitrification or the cost of moving the wells to the creek compartment, you have to bounce it off other costs. Otherwise, those costs are going to be asked. Why didn't you go to brackish water? Why didn't you go to desal? Well, there's going to be a cost analysis, and it's on that list for that very purpose, so that everybody can see the relative cost of what the solutions are. If you didn't have a desal cost or a brackish water cost, you wouldn't understand the relative cost or of the ultimate solution. So I wanted to make that comment, and I probably have some other comments towards the end too.
All right, thank you. Alan, who's Martha? Somebody, let's go. I'd like to get everybody that has questions or comments the opportunity to get them answered since we have Rob and Spencer here.
Martha Golden. Well, I have a comment and a question. Just in hopes that the question will be answered with some specificity, I'll ask the question first. The peer review, did it specifically evaluate the assumptions and conclusions of the Los Osos wastewater project on our basin, specifically the benefits or not of the Brodersen leach fields? And with respect to that, please be specific if the answer is yes, it was evaluated. Ag reuse and its effects on saltwater intrusion, was that considered? Was it, I'll just throw in another one, what happens if we go right to the edge and we've got the maximum salt water there and the farmers won't touch it? Anyhow, I'd like to know what was evaluated and what the results of that evaluation was, the conclusions that you drew with respect to balancing the basin. Now, my comment before everybody falls asleep, because I know that everybody, that the engineers and the geologists love all the technical data they have been presenting, and some of the people here are extremely interested and can assimilate it. I have to admit that I can't. So I just have a little bit of a layperson's question. The prior model, which apparently is basically the same model used now, was... it failed in predicting by some, 1,200% what the saltwater intrusion was over a relatively short period of time. What makes us think that you've got it right this time? I've heard that we'll have to keep evaluating and examining and see, and that there are a lot of questions and... So we're going to plunge ahead with some kind of an ISJ without having a model that worked in the past and without knowing what the current model is going to do in the future. Also, if we have to shift pumping to the upper aquifer, which has nitrates, and that's the basic purpose of the wastewater project, why are we going to be paying for nitrate reduction with all of its attendant ecological problems and a wastewater project?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. If I may. Trying to rid myself of the jargon here. The model was focused on water supply as it relates to the ISJ group. It did look at the scenario where 448 acre feet was applied at Broaderson. It looked at Broaderson and then the safe yield of the basin. So I want to make that clear. There was a question about this model. Did it fail to predict some of the thin layers and so forth that we're seeing now? And to be, I think, as a layperson as I can, I sit in some of these groups countywide, and I haven't seen, and I've seen, you know, a dozen groundwater hydrologists address these issues. I don't think there's a model in the county that's as detailed as this one. It's been peer-reviewed. That doesn't mean it's perfect. It doesn't have all those thin layers in there. It's a tool. If there was something better, I would be putting the cost on the table tonight and telling you how to get there. But this is as good a tool as other folks in the county have, and I think John can back me on that, being involved in some of the other groundwater groups. We'll be transparent with the information and tell you what we have, but it's as good a tool as we have. As far as the shifting and pumping, why are we paying for an expensive nitrate removal project in the wastewater project? I won't go too far into this, but if I might, the Porter-Cologne Act says that you can't put it in the ground, contaminate the water, and treat for it when you pump it out. You have to prevent it from going in the ground in the first place, and I know that that's painful for folks when it's so expensive, but that's the law. If I said that correct, John.
If I just add a little bit what Rob says, sort of keep in mind what Rob said about the Porter-Cologne Act is correct. The teeth behind the Regional Water Quality Control Board is discharge orders, and as far as this project goes, it was nitrate removal. There was a good question: why are we going to then pay to with this nitrate, the potential nitrate project to remove nitrates, and that clearly is to address seawater intrusion in the near term. I mean, theoretically, if the wastewater treatment project is successful and nitrates are naturally flushed out through the recharge at Broaderson or wherever, you know, obviously we will not have to continue with the nitrate removal project. Or it'll be severely lessened.
Okay.
I called it a finger intrusion about 3 months ago. And I believe the report was not released then. I kind of remember about 3 years ago, Mr. Harris, that you talked about sulfur. I could give you 15 minutes lecture about why you don't find trimethoprim along with sulfur, even though they're frequently prescribed together. All four wells that were tested in that original report came back with constituents of septic tanks, including coffee. There's probably some natural nitrates behind that. There's probably some old farm influences and horses. But the bottom line is it is dirty water on the upper compartment. In an ideal world, you just mix, you'd have, the upper compartment would have just nitrates, the lower compartment would have just salts at the very limit. You'd mix them and the two flows, and all of a sudden you've got water that's potable. In reality, we have a lot of other constituents. But let me get back to what needs to be paid attention to here. The saltwater intrusion up and down the coast moves in at a line as long as the wells are far away. I predicted this model. I stated that there was a finger intrusion because I saw what was going on. There are layers of gravel and layer of sands and layer of clay. We know that because that's what happens when you dig a well. That's what you come across. Every 100 feet or so, every 20 feet or so, you come across one of those. When you have the differential that is caused, and that's where my question will be, is it the direct influence of pumping out of a single production well, which is drawing, through a draw vector, is drawing in the salt water directly to it, or is it the aggregate pull that is created by the basin itself being depleted through many wells? But let's get back into what the shape of the finger is. What happens with the finger intrusion is that you have the pull. As the pull, as the pressure from the salt water meets the negative pressure from the draw away from the well, you have a more significant pull, and you have a restructuring through the gravel beds and higher rates of flow. So you probably don't, you have, probably have 1,000 feet a year rate of travel along the last 6 months, because it's an accelerating process, but it's a very localized process. There's something called area under the curve. The actual volume of salt that entered the basin is probably fairly small, because it is a direct dagger pointed at...
Thank you, Alon. The acceleration of seawater is occurring because you have a trough which is developed in the lower aquifer. And that trough is caused by individual wells that are producing. So, you know, everything you said, I agree with. It's the effects of the acceleration are both the regional trough and its constituent wells that are actually pulling the water in. And, you know, I think I mentioned that at the presentation, that indeed as you approach the pumping well, your hydraulic gradient is steeper, and so you do have an acceleration there. The question of stopping the pumping, you know, if you stop the pumping, you're going to see a fairly immediate effect on the pressures, and that will also have a fairly immediate effect on the movement of seawater. In some of the information that we have from PECHO, which is the Golden State Water Company, well, they've managed to control chlorides through, you know, through pumping and their operation of that well. So there is an effect that you have when you stop pumping on where the chlorides are going. Obviously, because water levels are depressed to the extent they are, that they're not, you're not going to stop the intrusion by stopping pumping immediately. It will still continue to come in, but what happens near a pumping well is that you have a pretty dramatic rebound when you stop production, and so that very high rate of acceleration will attenuate around that pumping well. But the trough itself, that's what will continue to draw water in at a slower rate.
It's a safe yield for the basin, since Corello Engineering, a company hired by the county, has already reported that this community is in an overdraft right now. That's number one question. Golden State has already charged for nitrogen treatment at the wellhead for denitrification. And if the Port of Cologne Act says that you have to recharge with clean water, then why do they not denitrify at the wellhead and repump that water into their system and not make us pay an additional cost? Or if it is an additional cost through the denitrification, adjust it that way. Do we have any idea of how many wells are in the basin and are drawing water? Any idea? Because the wells that have been counted and reported are not adequate. There are more wells being used in this water basin than have been reported. It's not difficult to understand if you go out and you have looked at old records of the county to find out, and they have not been abandoned, nor have they been capped, all of them. Some of them are not used on a direct basis every day or every week, but they are used. Therefore, they are still withdrawing water from our basin. Since we are in a 2008 and the ISJ began in 2008, we have from 08 to now, when is this ISJ going to be, shall we call it, completed and this basin plan put into effect so we no longer have as much seawater intrusion as we have? Because every day, every minute that this ISJ is not adjudicated, saltwater intrusion is taking place and it's not being addressed in a manner that is going to protect this basin.
Thank you. And Richard will be our last speaker, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Some of these questions have been asked before, so if you could give a briefer response.
Understood. Just let me know, as it's hard, of course, to do that. As far as the overdraft in the basin, we are in a state of overdraft. When seawater intrusion occurs, we're definitely there. We do have part of our basin that's not in overdraft, which we're not fully utilizing now, the upper zone. I addressed that briefly, but as far as the timing of the basin management plan, as the year comes to a close, I think you'll see a draft out there. Sure.
Well, we've identified 240 wells approximately in the basin that are in the model that pump. Of course, there are other wells out there. There are a lot of old wells in Quested by the Sea and Baywood, and you know, the extent that those wells are being used, you'd have to do a, you know, door-to-door on that and find out. You know, we've identified and included as many wells as we could.
Okay, Richard, and then we'll close public comment.
Richard Margetson. I was actually hoping tonight that we would have seen the presentation that was given at the Water Ops meeting, because I couldn't make that meeting, but I understand that the presentation was much longer than what was seen tonight, which means only a few people actually saw the entire presentation. I have a couple of comments, and then I have a policy question that I would like Rob to answer as our district engineer. And with that hat on and not the hat of working with the ISJ or working with the county on any of these issues. Saltwater intrusion has increased over the last 4 years at a more rapid rate. Drought has something to do with that acceleration, but we keep touting water conservation as the one of the saviors of the basin, but when this district was formed, at one point, the CSD Water Department pumped 400 million gallons a year. 400 million gallons. We're down this year to roughly 270 million. That are pumped. So there's been a dramatic reduction in pumping in the district. Recently stated that he believes our opportunity for build out in the future is through one of those one of those ordinances, which has a requirement of 2-to-1 savings. The builder has to show 2-to-1 savings of water potential water consumption in the future to water saved through retrofits around the community. My question is that a proper policy when we continue to have seawater intrusion, and no matter how much we save, you're not reversing seawater intrusion. you still have seawater intrusion moving forward each year, maybe at a slower rate, but I don't believe that's one of the initial, after the sewer project is completed, policies that needs to be in place. I think that needs to be seriously looked at and evaluated. And there's many things to talk about, but that I would like an answer as our district engineer, not as working for the ISJ or the county.
Thank you. Could you answer that as the district engineer?
I can certainly take a shot at it.
We'll close the public hearing, and okay. This will be the last set of answers.
Very good. I think in my view, you know, there's been lots of communities who have done development-funded offset retrofit programs. I think the risk that we have to be aware of is that if we don't implement some of the retrofits now, that perhaps the development community that would like to do, then we can't wait to do those conservation programs that take those retrofits off the table, that see that water savings. We can't wait for those to be scooped up in the future. However much we want to see folks who are infill lots develop, those retrofits need to move forward right now. As to the relative multiplier, how many times above your estimated water use you need folks to offset, that's a question I think, well, John may want to speak to that, but I've seen a variety of factors there, and I've seen those challenged, and I've seen 2 to 4. John, you might be able to speak to that, but my view as district engineer is you can't wait to see those retrofits occur in the future. They have to be done now, and that seawater intrusion has to be balanced now under current demands, and then those folks who are looking to develop future lots, they need to be funding those programs that which will...
Now, I may have a misunderstanding of the water conservation plan that was approved by the Coastal Commission, but I don't think there are going to be significant retrofits available for new development, principally because new development cannot occur... Well, let me say it a little bit different. Significant new development cannot occur... or development of vacant lots within the prohibition zone until an Estero plan amendment is approved by the Coastal Commission. And I think the way the Coastal Commission phrased it, that local coastal program amendment must be heavily weighted for evidence of water resources to serve the vacant lots. So I agree with everything that Rob just said. I think you're going to see retrofitting not as a condition of new development, but as a condition to connecting to the project itself.
Okay, with that, then we'll go to questions or comments from the board, and we'll start with Chuck.
Do you have an estimate for how long it'd take to get some of the denitrification units online? I mean, how long before that project's in place? As we heard, it's been talked about for a long time.
President,
funding
is the big issue there. The it's not a complicated, space intensive, footprint intensive. It's a fairly routine. I mean, I just implemented a small one for a small utility, and it took us a month to plan and a month to do it. I'm not saying it's that fast, but this is not new technology that needs to be restudied. Brian was the most significant challenge, and that's been addressed as to what we do with that. It's just a matter of funding and implementation. I mean, we could, if we had the money today, we could pull off a project and get a coastal development permit, and the physical construction is probably a 3 to 4 month construction.
I would agree with everything, because I think the one thing that Rob pointed out was implementing a fair and equitable funding mechanism is certainly a challenge. And the second one is, he mentioned the word coastal development permit, which is a regulatory requirement. And, you know, you can estimate that, but it'd be very difficult to be accurate.
Steve, do you have any questions?
Well, let me just say it a little. First of all, I'm giving you my interpretation of coastal permits, and so I'm not going to stand on my, I'm not going to bet money on this, but the way I understand it, that the idea is there's, what, $5 million that is squirreled away for water conservation as part of the plan. The plan calls for a 50-gallon per day per person water consumption as part of the project. The project serves within the prohibition zone. My take on that is that the only way that you're going to achieve 50 gallons per day per person is through an extensive retrofit program on houses as they connect to the project. That was one of the basis of the other project that the district had before, was similar in concept. As to retrofitting, that's the unknown, and you just hit upon it, is retrofitting other properties that aren't within the prohibition zone that received pumped water from the groundwater basin is still, I'm going to use this word, ambiguous as to how the retrofitting will work. Obviously, they won't be retrofitting to connect to the project because they won't be connecting to the project.
Thank you. Director Kelly.
First, a clarification. I think for Richard had a comment about the presentation at the last Utilities Advisory Committee meeting, and that was not on this. That was on the first kind of draft of the Water Master Plan update, where we discussed capital improvement supply versus, you know, current infrastructure repair. And so, and I'll give my verbal report. So I think we'll see some cost analysis as the Water Master Plan comes before us in, what, about 4 to 6 weeks. So I'll give a little more at that time. But, yes, it was a different presentation.
Director Sparks.
Mr. Miller or Spencer, did not we consider doing the transient? You mentioned we're using the steady state model. So wasn't it an option at one time to consider using the transient model, and collectively the decision weighed not to do it at this time?
Mr. President, yes, that's correct. At that time,
we did that, made that decision because we felt we weren't the usefulness of that wasn't going to be justified, or I should say needed at that necessary at that time to make our policy decisions.
We felt that it wouldn't change the answer or the direction, and it was several hundred thousand dollars, as I recall, and 6 months of time at least. And to take that much time doing additional study when you didn't believe it would change your focus or direction didn't seem to be a worthwhile justification.
And now that we have the studies that we have and the peer review, is there anything that has changed in your opinion of that as to should we at this time consider doing that transient model based on now that the data we have from the studies?
No, we still, our direction's still the same, which is that over the long term, we'd like to see the expense of that transient model, the time that it takes, built into a long-term monitoring program for this basin. We're always going to be working on this model. But as to our current steps, we feel like we're taking the correct steps in terms of the model, and that it's not worth stopping everything and re-looking at that at this time.
And so what would that, if we were to do that transit model, what additional information would that give us?
It would allow us, and Spencer, feel free to enhance this, it would allow us to look at seasonal fluctuations in water levels, water quality, be a better prediction of what we would measure out of physical wells during drought periods versus wet periods. That's why we thought that model would be appropriately tasked to the future monitoring phase of the basin, because it's a monitoring tool more than it is a direction-setting tool. We feel like we have the direction-setting tool.
And is that, I know I'm sounding like a little bit of a trial lawyer here, but is that in any way, do you think, precluding maybe making, we've heard, let me backtrack, we've heard comments about discharge into the creek compartment and utilizing creek compartment. Is that in any way, because the creek is more of a transient flow, is that in any way precluding us from making or has precluded us from making a proper evaluation of usefulness of the of the creek compartment, either with the wastewater project or, you know, as a purveyor.
We feel that the existing model is sufficient to do any analysis of the creek compartment, including discharge, that we would need to do and give us.
Best management practices that we'll be considering direction on later tonight is partially triggered by the seawater intrusion and is one of the means that we're looking forward to in the immediate short term to start addressing this issue. So we do have that item later on our agenda. I'd like to thank both you guys for coming. I think it's been very informative, and I think, you know, your care and attention in answering the questions is really appreciated because we got detailed answers to the questions, so I appreciate it. I appreciate the members of the public, too, for their participation. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do is not take a break. If we need individual breaks, I'd like to do that because I just really don't want to break up the meeting for 15 minutes here. So unless somebody has an objection to that, I'd like to continue through with the agenda nonstop. Okay. So with that, we'll move to the administrative and committee reports. We'll start with CAL FIRE, and I appreciate the chief being here. I know you've got concerns about fireworks.
Good evening, Mr. President, members of the board, members of the public. I have before you the May 2010 Chiefs Report. And in the month of May, Station 15 South, they responded to 99 calls, with seven of them being simultaneous calls. At least one of those seven calls were required advanced life support from your paramedics. Of those 99, 78 were medical aids, with 25 of them requiring advanced life support, four traffic collisions, and five were reported as fires. Company 15 returned to the fire station to assist the CAL FIRE staff a total of 16 times in the month of May. Also in the month of May, firefighter John Kellett, a local resident here, was accepted to the nursing program at Cuesta College. He was one of our rookie firefighters and decided to submit his resignation with the expectation that he will try and return once he completes his nursing program. Some training was done within the month as well. Engineer Peterson attended a mobile communications center technician class. This is a class that helps him on large fires to run mobile communication centers. And we will be getting one of those mobile communication vehicles here in San Luis County within the next couple months. And we did a couple outreach, and in some cases, the state's public resources code and 477 notices of violation were sent out the first week of June. Later that month, they reinspected those 477. 67 notices of violations for a second violation were mailed in the last day or two, with the third inspection to be, which is a citable inspection, to be done the third week of July. So if anyone out there listening received one of those 60, or will receive one of those 67 notices, please complete the abatement or give us a call and we'll work with you to see what we can do to mitigate it. It is, as you mentioned earlier, July 4th weekend, and as you're all aware, there is no safe and sane or dumb and dangerous or any other type of fireworks within the community of Los Osos or the county areas of San Luis Obispo. There's only a couple of jurisdictions that do allow fireworks. There are plenty of scheduled fireworks shows in the surrounding area. And so we will have myself and one other peace officer in the North Coast area on patrol. And I think it was approximately 2 years ago they increased the fines for any type of firework, including the illegal fireworks. And so it's now somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,000 fine if you're caught in possession of a illegal firework. So we strongly encourage people to watch the good shows and not use the bad ones. That didn't work very well, did it? All right. Finally, I'd like to thank everyone who helps the South Bay Reserves in their support for Holly Novalt. They were able to raise approximately $3,500 for the family, and so we talked about that a couple weeks ago in my last chief's report. I just wanted to say thanks to the staff that supported us, as well as the general public. Is there any questions I can answer for you?
I had a question of fireworks in, it seems like a no-brainer, but a friend of mine got caught doing it one time. Fireworks on the beach, either in Montana or on the sand dunes. What's the status of use of fireworks?
All fireworks, regardless of whether they're approved in California or not, are prohibited in the county areas throughout all of San Luis Obispo County.
It's a laser fireworks, so it's a short trip across South Bay Boulevard to Morro Bay, so there's no reason to do your own this year.
Absolutely. Morro Bay, Cayucas, and Cambria will all be doing big shows.
Any other question? Director Sparks?
No question. I just, Chief Veneris, I just want to, again, thank you for your community outreach, your fundraiser in June, and as well for your response to incidents in June as well. Thanks.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, then, we'll move to the Utility Department's report. The utility departments, you're off the hook, Chief. You can go.
Thank you, President Ohilski. In the utilities department, staff performed routine water sampling and well soundings and performed maintenance on our various sites, equipment, and vehicles. A fire hydrant at Santa Isabel in Pasadena was discovered to be inoperative and is scheduled for replacement as described in detail in Agenda Item 5H. Also, as mentioned before, the flow meter on the Palisades well is relatively old and stopped working in May. Agenda Item 5J will authorize replacement of this meter. Also, this has been a busy time for reporting, as the monthly compliance report and the 2009 annual report were both submitted to the Department of Public Health. In addition, the consumer confidence report was published and mailed out to district water customers. All reports indicate that the water provided by the district meets or exceeds all state drinking water standards. Total production for May was 25 million gallons, which represents a decrease of about 5% over last year. 57% of the district's water service area was billed for approximately 23.5 million gallons, consumed between April 11th and June 10th, with a corresponding revenue of around $140,000. These numbers represent a decrease of about 14% when compared to last year's numbers for this same period of time. Office staff and field crews have been evaluating a couple of types of valve exercising machines. These machines can be mounted on a trailer or on a truck bed and are used to fully operate valves through several cycles of open and closed to break loose any crustiness and ensure smooth and complete operation. The machines are very precise in the amount of torque that is applied to the operating nut on top of the valve, and which is ultimately controlled by the operator by way of an electronic control device. And that's a critical feature in avoiding damage to stuck or sticky valves. Older methods of using brute strength or cheater bar, safer for staff and less likely to result in damage to the water distribution system. That concludes the utilities report. I'm available to answer any questions.
Any questions from the directors? Seeing none, we'll move to the Administrative Department report.
Okay, yes, thank you again,
Seems
President.
Seems like Mr. Gilmore is on the hook for everything.
That's a cost-saving measure. The general liability, automobile, E&O, and workers' compensation insurance have been bound. The district is fully insured for the fiscal year of 2010-11. That's good news. Some members of the administrative staff attended online ethics training and a human resources seminar in San Luis Obispo last month. Certificates were issued upon completion of those classes. Also, administrative staff have been busy preparing the new website for our go-live date of July 15th. Several comments from the public about the availability of agendas and other reports. Believe me, staff's working very hard to generate additional web pages that will respond to those concerns. As you likely recall, with a shift to a new web services provider, staff training and in-house updating of the district website was included. This will allow us to be more responsive and more thorough in our provision of information to the public. One of the new features of the this change is a new additional web address. While the old address will continue to work for the new site, the new address will be the much simpler form of locsd.org. The way you don't have to worry, count your OSes before you enter in the web address. We'll get the word out on Channel 20 as soon as we go live on July 15th to reach everyone in the community. That's it for the administrative report. Any questions?
No.
Oh, yes. Yes, Steve. Director, Vice President, Senate.
Thank you. For the general liability, were the costs about the same this year as in the past?
That's my understanding, was that the insurance costs didn't change much.
Good. Mm-hmm. Great.
All right, thank you. Then we'll move to the District General Manager report, which I believe Mr. Gilmore will be giving also.
Yes, thank you, President Ohilski. On June 4th, district offices were closed so that staff could participate in a working retreat. The retreat was coordinated and facilitated by Delia Horwitz of Business Relationship Consultants. The purpose of the retreat was to spend some time together in a neutral setting to reflect on the history of the district and the challenges faced by the conversations were both work-related and non-work-related. After lunch, we reconvened in our meeting room and spent the rest of the day exploring different personality types and communication styles. Our facilitator, Delia, had some great tools to use when dealing with coworkers and customers that have different styles than our own. Besides being a spectacular day, the information shared and lessons learned were very constructive. Feedback from staff was very positive, and we'll all continue to utilize and benefit from the skills we learned on that day. I'd like to publicly thank Delia Horwitz, especially for her sensitivity and her time and for working within some very limiting budgetary constraints. That concludes the General Manager's report. You can answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Vice President, Senate.
Just a brief comment on the retreat. Our district personnel are one of our greatest resources, and I'm happy to see that we've invested that effort into reaffirming their value and trying to facilitate communication. Good things.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, it was very well received.
Yes, I had to go out there to get you to sign something, so it was a very nice day, I have to tell you that. Committee reports, we have none in our agenda package. Does ESAC have a report?
Yeah, we had, myself, I was able to make it, and a couple committee members were able to make it, and so we decided to not hold the meeting in June. So we will hold a meeting in July, I believe on the 20th of July at the fire station.
The Financial Advisory Committee, we did meet last week. There was two things. We just went through and talked about the procedures being followed in the budgeting and the management. And there was a clarification made, I think, that finally got through to us, that when we do the budget adjustments in the budget, we're not really adjusting the budgets. What we're doing is doing what's legally required. We're really increasing the appropriation. So I think that using the technology of appropriation rather than budget adjustment made a lot of sense to the Financial Advisory Committee, because that made it clear as to why we do these regular adjustments. Secondly, at our next meeting, which will be August 16th, we are going to have a discussion of accounting policy and procedures and whether we need to adopt some additional policies and procedures.
But we are, from that point on, we make the budget adjustments. It's my understanding we are changing that yearly budget from that point forward.
Right. Yep. Okay, with that, we'll go to Utility Advisory.
The Utility Advisory Committee did meet, and Rob Miller and Valerie, I believe, from Wallace Group, were present to do an overview of the water master plan update and to solicit some questions and comments and considerations for the committee in the future regarding prioritization and just to discuss some of the issues. Rob also went over previous projects that were implemented under the previous water master plan. Most of it had to do with fire flows, bringing the fire flows up to an adequate level. There's still some areas that need to be addressed. and he really could only discuss infrastructure, as a lot of our supply issues are in the ISJ. But he was able to touch on, I think, enough of the issues that one of the comments was to come back with, make sure that we're aware of some of the cost-benefit analysis and what the costs were as we go through prioritizing storage, fire flows, all these issues. So that it was very informative. Again, I didn't... it was not the whole picture or the complete picture. When he comes back, it'll be before the whole community, and the committee can submit any comments, questions, or concerns. And there were some solicited in construction cost timing. You know, what were the facility needs? What are revenue enhancing repairs to the infrastructure as it stands? Whether it's metering, valves, what the issues were, and that's about it. But he'll come back before the whole board and community with that draft in about 4 to 6 weeks.
Any questions? Attendance at other agency committee meetings. I have one. Does anybody else have any? Okay, I did attend the California Coastal Commission meeting regarding the wastewater project. Our board, as everybody knows, approved a letter that we sent in to the California Coastal Commission. Interestingly enough, the day we sent it in was a furlough day, so we didn't get a response. However, Dr. Lester, who is the acting executive director of the Coastal piece of property, unfortunately, in my estimation, it did not address our concerns. I met with Dr. Lester on the day before the hearing, Thursday night, down in Marina Del Rey, and he did adjust the language again, and they orally adjusted the language to address our concerns, and they adopted different language actually at their hearing on Friday. Clearly, we don't know how the bankruptcy court or the people in bankruptcy are going to view this, but it did put us in a better negotiating position because it put less encumbrances on the parcel than the previous two renditions of that language. So the commission did adopt the language that was closest to what we could live with. It requires that the county, as part of the wastewater project, restore the Midtown site, and that future use of the property would require a local coastal plan amendment before it could be used. So it's not encumbered forever now as mitigation for the wastewater project. The only requirement on the wastewater project is to restore the site. So we were pretty happy with that result. I think Director Kelly has one thing to add, and then we'll move. I will give the LOCAC report because the chair cannot be here unless you would like to give it. Okay.
I didn't. The other item on our agenda was the discussion around the BM. The ad hoc conservation committee had suggested some BMPs, but that I think will be addressed and discussed with the conversation around the BMPs, and then the rest of the ad hoc committee is here for comments as to how we got that. So.
All right, thank you. Vicki Millage called me up this afternoon, said she could not be here. She said that there was two items, and if I say something wrong, because I did not attend the whole meeting, one is that LOCAC supported the abandonment of Highland Avenue, the paper street, to bring into concurrence with the most recent circulation element. And then the second item was that LOCAC is going to revisit the school solar installations. So unless those are the two items that she mentioned to me, was there anything else? No? Okay. So that would be the LOCAC report. Response to previously asked questions, I think we've answered all the ones that I'm aware of through our seawater intrusion and through our closed session discussion. So unless somebody else has a question, we'll move right to the consent calendar. Does anybody have an item on the consent calendar they'd like to pull?
There's a funding issue, or the purchase has to be approved by resolution, and the resolution wasn't included in the agenda packet. There are copies in the back, and you've been provided with copies of the resolution. So what we'd be asking is for you to approve the resolution so that we can make that purchase.
Do we have to do that by separate action, John?
No, you're... the requirement of approving the consent calendar is by roll call vote. So
okay. So no director wants to pull any items. With that, then we'll move into public comment on the administrative report, committee reports, or the consent item calendar.
George Taylor, Los Osos. I have some questions and some really concerns about 5-H. I would like to ask a direct question to our district general manager to explain the complete circumstances of this incident. The incident, I'll just read this much of it and then get his response to it. On May 11th, almost 2 months ago, 2010, the fire hydrant at the corner of Pasadena Avenue and Santa Isabel Street was bagged and reported as out of service by the district crew leader and subsequently reported the broken hydrant to personnel at CDF station number 15. The crew leader asked that the hydrant be replaced by a contractor because the water crew, was currently shorthanded. That's almost 2 months ago. California Fire Code, listen up. California Fire Code requires fire hydrants be maintained and in operational condition at all times. 2 months is not at all times. And as a homeowner here in Los Osos, I would be very irate if I was to know that there was a fire. Well,
after public, at the end of public comment.
Good evening again, Julie Tacker. I'll start with the fire hydrant, item 5H. First of all, when you go through the bids, there's different scopes of work, and it's actually difficult to discern which is the actual low bid. I'd like you all to get your calculators out and really figure out what these guys bid on, because they're different. Each contractor bid on something else. They're not the same. You can't compare them. A few months ago, or it might have been a year ago, I watched our crew replace a fire hydrant. It took a couple of days. It took longer to actually get the parts to do it than do the work. But the fact is, they're qualified and they can do it. So in-house, I would bet, is less expensive. This item, George points out, was 2 months in the making. Didn't go to your committees, utility or your finance committee. This is almost $10,000 that we're talking about. It should have been discussed at the committee level. On item 5I, there's almost $10,000 going to the South Bay well. Well, it looks like blending is off the table. So we've spent what I guesstimate, because I asked for an audit. I haven't seen that. I don't know that you guys are going to ask for one. I think you should. You should know how much money you've spent on that project. And I estimate that we're approaching the $300,000 mark to get a well where you already had a well. And then a question that didn't get answered really in the earlier presentation was this pumping at Palisades. You know, sure, we're going to spend the money and it's a nice piece of equipment that can be moved to another well in the future. But the fact is, the question didn't get answered. Is it prudent to continue to pump that well? And then Marshall's report on the Coastal Commission, I just have to say that, you know, you might feel somewhat victorious, but the fact is, Tri-W is de facto encumbered. Like every other vacant lot in this town, there's no water, there's no sewer, there's no habitat. And in this case, it's going to be required double the mitigation for someone who wants to.
Okay, Frank, you'll be the last speaker, and we'll close public. Oh.
Frank,
I'm only trying to egg you in to have something to say, Richard.
Frank Casiliola, Associates. I have a question regarding the water ops with also the RAC. It's kind of a combination. This board has supported a basin-wide plan for a long time and a shared cost equitably across to the basin. And the RAC is going to be discussing reviewing the most current seawater intrusion issue. And I'd like to see the board give direction to the people, Maria, that attends, as well as Dan, when there is opportunity for public input into that issue, to bring that issue forward, that there is a basin-wide, even though Mr. Seitz says that it's hard to bring in the people who have private wells into it, the county can do the 218, do a conservation district special tax fund issue, which would deal with some of the issues you've discussed regarding buying property for catch basements, doing landscape funds, doing conservation in those areas that are not going to be hooked up to the wastewater system. So it'd be more equitably based, whether it's a 218 or a special tax similar to the fire tax. So I'd like to see, you know, more vocal about that issue, because I don't know what you do behind closed doors. We don't get to see that. And direct that to the people who attend these meetings, as well as try to get Mr. Seitz on board to encourage him to look at maybe, you know, the county doing a 218 or a special tax that would be basin-wide to deal with all these issues that have brought up earlier. But we've got to do it first in these meetings that are the RAC meet-in. The water ops need to bring forward some of that issue, I think. The RAC meet-in needs to hear, people in the county need to hear that. But it needs to come from you. Thank you.
Thank you. I really didn't mean to egg you in. We'll close public comment after Richard then.
Richard Margeson, I'm sorry. I was talking to Rob Miller about a people helping people issue. So I didn't hear the finance report. Did you talk, or did you give a finance report? Okay. Did you talk at all or inform the other directors of some of the issues that we're going to be discussing?
To give us a price. There's a couple of ways of trying to expedite those types of projects. Perhaps we could consider a policy whereby my authority for certain spending levels would be increased in situations where hydrants are involved. I definitely consulted with Phil Venaris, fire chief, to make sure that there was adequate fire hydrant density that would allow protection of those homes in the event of a fire, even with that hydrant out of service. And so that's the reason that took the time that it took. We could have been more responsive, but needed board approval for that level of funding under current policies. With respect to the South Bay well and blending is not off the table. As mentioned previously in the seawater intrusion discussion earlier tonight, it appears from the monitoring wells that the nitrate level in the lower aquifer is beginning to decrease. I'm not exactly sure why, because we haven't been pumping that well. But the idea is to, as mentioned before, do the upgrades needed to the controls so that the lower aquifer well can pump. The nitrates are below the maximum contaminant level of the state standards. It does meet state standards. Once we see improvement in that water quality, then we'll and once it becomes more suitable for blending, then we'll begin to pursue that project again. With respect to the Palisades well, I mentioned that the flow meter is. And Rob Miller also mentioned that the flow meter is a very high-quality meter. It's a nice piece of equipment. It does a lot of things that other meters don't do. It's state-of-the-art technology. And if it's not used at the Palisades well, it can certainly be used at any of the new wells. And we're reluctant to take that well offline until we have a replacement well, because we're required to be able to provide and meet the demands of the community for, as far as water quantity. So until we have another source for water, that well is going to need to remain active and available for us to utilize. with respect to the RAC meeting, I did attend the RAC meeting. I didn't go into a detailed report tonight. The written general manager's report in your packet did include that, and there was a vote to reconvene a committee to look at the products of the ISJ, specifically the four technical memoranda and the seawater intrusion study. That committee or that subcommittee is tasked with reviewing those documents for the purpose of, well, that'll all come out of the ISJ process and the recommendations, and those will be, we'll take the recommendations of our district engineer, and they're beginning to look at locations for replacement wells that will follow the recommendations of.
So it's not the new South Bay well, though. That's not.
If you're referring to the South Bay well that we already have, that would be another well. Another additional wells at okay. another location.
Okay. Okay, any other questions? If not, can I have a motion on the consent calendar, please?
I'll make a motion to receive the administrative and committee reports and approve the consent items with item 5G as amended with the resolution attached.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Any further discussion? We'll take a roll call vote, please.
Director Sparks?
Yes.
Director Kelly?
Yes.
Director Sassina?
Yes.
Vice President Senate?
Yes.
President Ogilski?
Yes. I need a motion now to continue the meeting past 10, if I could get one, or we can go home. It's your guys' call.
I move that we continue the meeting past 10 o'clock to finish this evening's agenda.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to that? Seeing no objection, we'll do it by consensus roll call vote. With that, then, we'll move to item 6A, which is the water conservation best management practices.
Thank you again, President Ohilski. This agenda item addresses three separate issues relating to water conservation. First, it conveys the work of the Utilities Advisory Committee in identifying and prioritizing the water conservation best management practices, or BMPs, that will be the focus for the $30,000 in conservation funding identified in the district's 2010-11 fiscal year budget. Secondly, it seeks board direction to staff to clean up the district code by separating water conservation from emergency water shortage regulations. And third, the recommended action seeks direction from the board to have staff establish a water waste prevention ordinance for consideration at a future date. Developed in 1991 and updated in 1997, a list of 14 BMPs was established by the California Urban Water Conservation Council. The district's adopted urban water management plan, dated December 7th of 2000, identifies only two of those BMPs for implementation by the district. The CSD actually complies with six or more of the BMPs currently, while the king are listed in the staff report. The recommended action includes these program elements, although it is with a little more flexible language than the committee came up with. For example, the first priority consideration is for a specific number of the district's highest water users to be contacted directly for some form of water auditing. The recommended action softens this somewhat so that the committee and staff will have some flexibility in determining where the greatest water savings can be realized and how many audits can be performed with the funding that's available. Similarly, the other committee recommendations are included in the recommended board action. Research of the district code indicated that there's a need to clarify certain sections that refer to emergency water shortages as opposed to standard water conservation recommendations. They're included in the same chapter of the district code. The recommended action seeks direction from the board to separate out these two considerations for clarity and to emphasize that the recommended conservation measures to bring emphasis to the recommended conservation measures, even when there is no level of emergency water shortage. And finally, the recommended action also seeks direction from the board to return at a future meeting with a water waste prevention ordinance. Such an ordinance would include a list of activities that would constitute a waste of our water resources and would give district staff some authority in enforcing that ordinance. Many jurisdictions already have this type of ordinance, which, with the board's direction, we'll research and utilize in crafting an ordinance that's appropriate for the Los Osos Community Services District. That concludes my report, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions from board members?
Wait, Director Kelly, do you have a... I think she had a comment from...
Go ahead, Steve. You can go first. I just want to make sure that the members of the ad hoc committee that helped develop this have an opportunity to comment as to why these recommendations were born, if they should choose to do so.
Sure. Well, would it be appropriate to have them speak before public comment or after?
Before.
Good evening, members of the board. Excuse me, I'm fighting off a sore throat here. My name's Ron Munns, Los Osos resident. By night, during the day, professionally, I'm the conservation manager for the city of San Luis Obispo. It's been my pleasure to join the utilities.
Hold on, Leanne. One more.
Good evening. My name is Leonard Moodhart, resident of Los Osos. And I also wanted to thank the board for giving me an opportunity to serve on the Utilities Advisory Committee. It's been a great experience so far. But I did want to emphasize that one of the best management practices happens to be community involvement, and that's something I want to stress as we go through this process. This is meant for the entire community of Los Osos. Everybody's involved. Everybody knows how to turn off a faucet, and everybody has great ideas of how to conserve water. And so I just want to, as we proceed through this, to emphasize that aspect.
Okay, now we'll open to public comment. Leanne.
Well, this is a subject which I think needs a lot more study. And I think you need to spend some time talking to folks who have been successful in this area. It is a serious problem, and unfortunately, we've had people come and speak at our meetings before who've told us that taking care of the outside is too complicated, so therefore we should go for the inside, and we have little things like a plumbing retrofit kit, or having a plumber come in, and the plumber will certify that it's been retrofitted. Well, I used to be a plumber. I wouldn't trust a plumber to give you an answer that it was done that way. The problem is also one of some great expense. If you're really going to do something about the outside of your property and get rid of your lawn and go to native plants and put in a system, that will save water, it's going to cost you some money. And I don't think that we as purveyors have got the money in our that we're bringing in to the water district to give money to people as inducements to do this. So I just want to point out some of these enormous problems. And as far as these plumbers parade at this moment, but it really, you need to find a place, there must be a place somewhere in California where they've got an ordinance that works, or where they've got a program that works. Because if you're going to spend the time trying to invent that program, I say good luck.
Thank you. Glenn?
I concur with Mr. Golden, and I also would like to know through Mr. Seitz if there is some ordinance, because we are an unincorporated area and we have three water purveyors, one that doesn't even have meters on their residences, if there is a possibility to establish an ordinance. We are in a dire condition. People in this community have no idea, in many instances, that we are in a dire situation. They wash their cars, let the water run on the drives, let the water run in their yards, let new plants being developed consistently. yes, you have a problem in the CSA 9 project water system. We in Golden State have another problem because Golden State only raises the rates, and there are some people who could care less. S&T could care less, although they profess that they're concerned about water, yet they do not have any meters on their residences. There must be some way in which they can be forced to put one in under an ordinance, because this community is a community of total community that uses the water from one basin only.
Julie Tacker. Appreciate the work that the committee's doing. Would have liked to have seen the county's conservation plan a long time ago. Would love to see what the ISJ's doing so that we can see it all work together. Right now, we're just throwing darts, and you guys can be doing double the work. So that's unfortunate. $30,000, not a lot of money, but it is a lot of money to support an employee to do the things that Ron does for us, or for his community, or where he works. So a physical solution with $30,000, that's a lot of money that you could put towards some improvement that saves water. For example, in this letter I, you say targeting the highest water users. Well, we know that the middle school is the highest water user. If we took that $30,000 and put it towards an upper aquifer well, I saw an estimate in one of their letters that it was only $180,000 for an upper aquifer well. $30,000 gets you closer. And look how much water. That's no longer drinking water being sprayed on the grass. So we need to prioritize. A question I didn't ask earlier in the presentation, the ISJ stuff, but it kind of falls in here with water conservation. The recommendations for rainwater reuse and gray water. What's the cost benefit versus a xeriscape landscape? Reusing water to have a lush garden is counterproductive if you just don't have the lush garden. So we need to really look at our priorities and spend our money wisely, because the sewer's going to kill us.
Thank you. Any other public comment other than Richard? We'll close public comment after Richard then.
Richard Margetson, I just want to clarify, I'm a member of the subcommittee. It is only $30,000, but I don't think it all is paper. We realized it was only $30,000, and we're trying to get the most bang for the buck. This employee that was just talked about, this isn't going to be a staffed employee. It's going to be somebody who's hired on a part-time or contract basis, maximum contract, you know, to get the district going in a certain direction with water audits. The other component of this recommendation is to develop, one of the other recommendations is to develop this toilet retrofit rebate program. You know, the county is going to have a program in place at some point, but if at some point in the near future we can start attacking those 6-gallon toilets.
Yeah, I'll close the public hearing or public comment. Director Kelly.
Thank you to staff and specifically to the ad hoc committee. We agree that there's, you know, we have to start someplace. Even Rob Miller said, again, reiterated tonight, we can't wait, that whatever we can do now proactively is going to assist us in the long run regarding seawater intrusion, and that conservation is the cheapest water. And Ron can expound on that or how we talked about that. Also, the targeting the highest users, the one piece missing is that we're talking residential. We're not talking commercial. The BMPs that have been the list, the complete list of the 10, which I believe was in our last board packet, definitely in the last couple of Utilities Advisory Committee meetings, that the full list of BMPs that we've developed and I've submitted to this board, that we broke it out residential from commercial, and are targeting our residential first. And this is just a place to start to bring some conformity and clarity to the district's policies surrounding water conservation. So I look forward to hearing from the other board members and hope that we can find your support on moving forward with this project. It is not, I don't believe at this time, our expectation to right off the bat have that $30,000 spoken for. That's not what I believe we've been discussing. I think we're looking at, slowly figuring out how that we would spend that. We're not going to go out there right now and identify $30,000 in projects. That's the ongoing part of this process. So, we will be back with some priorities at a future date. Beyond the priorities we've identified here. Thank you.
Director Sparks.
I guess what's proposed here on the recommended motion is that not to do a contract, but that the contract would come back before the board for the water auditor. And I guess, in what I don't see in the priorities, we have a number of employees that are, I think have a good aptitude for an understanding of water conservation issues because they've participated in education. And so I guess my question to staff is in that priorities, I see the priorities as a contract with the water auditor and utilize contract. I just would like to see that that's under consideration because I know, I think we have employees that while they might not have been formally trained as a water auditor, have certainly demonstrated, the aptitude and have an understanding of, water use and conservation.
And I appreciate Director Sparks bringing that up. Yes, the idea why we targeted the first 120, and I believe I would like to see part of the contract that we do develop is that we would have staff as identified if appropriate or when appropriate that would be trained to take over that on-call. And again, Ron can elaborate if he wants to. A lot of the initial conservation response is over the phone. It isn't necessarily on-site auditing. And so, yes, we want to do the in-house initial 120, see if there's a way to train staff to field those initial phone calls and see if you can resolve the problem at that point in time. It wouldn't be that we would always have to have someone who's always on call to – does that make sense? Did I clarify that for you?
Excuse me. Yeah, thank you, Director Kelly. Yes, somewhat, but I guess the other question is not just – receiving the initial calls, but I mean, is there any issue with a staff member going out and doing on-site?
We would hope that they would be trained to do on-site audits as well. That the ongoing contract, it would not be an ongoing contract. It's an initial contract to get the district to a point where we've targeted those first 120, where we think we can actually see, immediate results, and then. Then if staff or as staff is available, yes, we would identify staff to be trained that could do audits as needed. And again, if you'd like, I think Ron can clarify that better if you want to ask.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to hear Ron's opinion. I want to make sure we're considering if there is some training that would get staff additionally versed in that. Thanks, Ron.
Sure. Ron Menz again, Los Osos. I think what we had envisioned is a couple of things here is, and Maria's right, once you send out these letters, you're going to get telephone calls back. And I think what we wanted to take is a more holistic approach. Before we do the letters, before we have the contractor, we have to have the information in place that, someone could actually do a self-audit, if that's what they wanted to do, instead of having a district staff or this contractor come out. We also envision having volunteers, whether it's district staff, volunteers, or whoever would like to participate in this program. So I think what we're looking at, and the other focus on between having the phone information where people, you know, my staff at the City of San Luis Obispo, we do most of us our audits on the telephone in about 15 or 20 minutes. I know that takes time out of doing other things, but that is, it, you know, we can do things on the phone, we can do things with information that can either be mailed or dropped off. But the other thing I think we need to see is really when we get on a property, what is really going on in homes in Los Osos? You know, what are the gallons of the toilets? What are the landscapes like? You know, what's going on? And I think the more we can get out in the community and understand how water is being used, it will really feed into when we get to whatever bigger program, you know, we get to with the ISJ or whatever. We just need more information. You know, my frustration as a community member, I've been hearing water conservation program coming for years. And finally, I said, you know, we got to do something. Like Rob Miller said, we can't afford to just sit back and wait any longer. So I look at, you know, with the district moving forward, it's taking that small step. You know, we're taking the small step into something we really have to solve. And I believe by, you know, like Maria said, we're not looking to go spend $30,000 right now. We need to get all our ducks in a row. We need to get the information set up. We need to get people trained and then get out there and try to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Muntz.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that, you know, from my perspective, it's a good first step. I mean, we need to start some time with something rather than keep talking about it, and I think it's a good first step for us to take. So is there any further discussion?
Well, I think one of the biggest parts of this effort is under 1C, public education and awareness. And I think we need to take the first step, but most of all, the citizens need to take a first step. And to do that, they need motivation, and they need to be aware. So I think we need to put a concerted effort into public awareness, and I think, you know, billboards around the community, maybe a staff to position where seawater intrusion has come in, just to raise the level of public awareness. My frustration is that even with all of my effort, I can't impact my own family. And maybe it's the way I deliver the message. We use water almost indiscriminately based on our upbringing. And what I look at as careless, other people say, what are you being so picky about? You know, it's only a little bit of water. So I don't know. It's an approach that we have to proceed with that's effective, and I think that's where our challenge lies, and I think this is the essence of our program.
Any other discussion, or do we have a motion?
I'll move that we approve item A, water conservation and best management practices, and instruct staff to move forward with the recommendations.
Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Any further discussion? I think without objection, we'll have a unanimous roll call vote. Seeing none, we have a unanimous roll call vote. That will move us to 6B.
Thank you, President Ohilski. This item includes the consideration of and the authority to send letters to state legislators regarding two pieces of legislation. The first is Assembly Bill 155, which would require local governments, including special districts, to gain approval from the California Debt and Investment Advisory Commission, or CDIAC, before filing for bankruptcy. The California Special Districts Association has analyzed the bill and taken a position against the measure. The reasons given by the CSDA for their position are detailed in the staff report and in the draft letter to Governor Schwarzenegger. In general terms, the CSDA opposes the measure on the grounds that it is an unnecessary addition of oversight that will only serve to undermine the protections that bankruptcy is intended to provide. The second bill is Senate Bill 972, which would limit public agencies from negotiating certain indemnification provisions with its consultants. The CSDA has taken the position that this bill would essentially replace upfront negotiated agreements with after-the-fact lawsuits. A recent update from the CSDA reports that the author of the bill, Senator Lois Wolk, will propose amendments to the legislation in the Assembly Judiciary Committee on Tuesday, July 6th, so that the end result will be the removal of the CSDA's opposition.
I have a question. Shouldn't we still send the letter with opposition to both? Because there's an assumption here that this will be removed, but it may not be. I mean, I'd prefer to stay with the letter the way it is, personally.
That's certainly acceptable.
I'm asking that as a question.
Yeah, that's certainly acceptable.
I know as far as the county CSDA, we're still in opposition to both of these items at this point.
So. Correct.
So is there any discussion? Otherwise, I'll make the motion myself to go ahead and approve sending the letter.
Both letters?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, I forgot public comment. Do we have public comment? Seeing none, we'll get back to it. We have a motion to authorize sending both of the letters.
And a second.
Any discussion now? Seeing none, we'll have a unanimous roll call vote unless there's an objection. Seeing no objection, it's approved unanimously. That brings us to the last item on our agenda, item 6C.
Yes, thank you again, President Ohilski. The CSDA has proposed several amendments to their bylaws, which requires approval of the association membership. The proposed amendments are considered to be very minor and will not have an appreciable effect on the district or its operations. It's recommended that the board authorize the general manager to enter the district's vote in favor of amending the bylaws. The CSDA is holding an election for the district floor representative to their board of directors. Four candidates are on the ballot, and statements from each of the candidates are included in the agenda packet. I'm recommending that the board enter its vote for Tim Ruiz for a couple of reasons. He's the general manager of the East Niles Community Services District, which provides water and sewer services to an unincorporated area of Kern County. Mr. Ruiz is also a licensed civil engineer and a graduate from Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. And as the director of his local chapter of CSDA and an active member of the American Society of Civil Engineers, he's very well qualified to represent Region 4 on the CSDA board. I do not know any of these candidates personally, so my recommendation is based solely on their personal statements and the qualifications that they listed for themselves.
Any questions? Public comment? No public comment. We'll close public comment. I don't think I have myself no questions about the bylaw amendment.
I'll make the motion to approve the selection of Tim Ruiz for the CP and amendment for the support of the amendment to the bylaws of the CSDA.
And a second.
Any further discussion? Any objection to unanimous roll call? Seeing none, the vote's unanimous. That will bring us to closing board comments. We'll start with Director Sparks this time.
Oh, yes. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I did indicate a couple of months ago I would give some information regarding the upcoming election. I want to remind the public we will have an election in November, and the filing deadline, I believe, is August 6th, Friday at 5 p.m. I will not be running for office again in November, so I just wanted to make sure that announcement was out today, and encourage everyone out there to consider running. It's instrumental for the district and the operation that we have people run and consider, and I think it's everyone's interest in Los Osos, if you are a citizen, to consider doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Sparks. Director Kelly?
I don't have any comments. Thank you. Have a safe, safe holiday weekend, please.
We'll go to Director Cecina.
July 17th, the corner of Bayview Heights and Ocean View, I think, the yard sale, benefit the homeless shelter. Drop your goodies off the day before and bring your cash that day. And bookend, I will not be running again either. August 6th, that's the filing deadline. So, Steve, get your papers ready.
Well, maybe if I say I'm uncertain, maybe that will make someone want to run.
Director Kelly and I are going to start to get a little paranoid here.
I think my comments about my former comments about conservation will be my closing comments, and I'll say goodnight.
Okay, I only have two closing comments. One is fireworks are illegal.
Let's go to Templeton.
We can go. Fireworks, remember, there's no laser show in Morro Bay this year. We have fireworks returning. I think that we need to do that. And I think the only other item that I have is the upcoming meeting. Our next regular session or regular meeting will be on August 5th.